The Guardian.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis, and coming up in today's podcast, Jack Barnett from These New Puritans on their forthcoming Hidden Live Tour, and how orchestras are more rock and roll than most indie bands.
We've only got one day rehearsal before we do it with the orchestra, and then some more rehearsal on the day, but apparently this is what they do all the time. Yeah.
Singles Club this week features Salem, Idiot Glee and Owen Pallett, and Disco Don Leo Zero on what makes a good re-edit and why what he does is not sacrilegious.
I did Lou Reed, Satellite of Love, and that was another kind of watershed for people going, oh dear, look at me, you know, very scornful looks. But it's just a re-edit. I'm not pissing on, you know, their golden artwork.
That's all in Music Weekly. Rosie Swash is with me.
Hi.
Hello, Rosie.
I've got a sunny disposition today.
Have you? I've got a very gloomy disposition.
I know, that's why I'm bringing it hard to the studio.
I'm pleased you have. Also, presumably bringing his ineffably sunny disposition to the studio. We have the culture editor of Guardian.co.uk, Alex Needham. Hello.
Hello.
You sunny? You feeling?
Yes,
yeah.
I'm feeling pretty sunny.
Yeah. Well, okay. Our first item today is an interview with Jack Barnett, the singer of These New Puritans. Their most recent album, Hidden, received pretty gushing reviews, with many people surprised that it didn't make the Mercury Prize shortlist. These New Puritans will soon be performing the album live with the help of a 16-piece brass and woodwind ensemble, multiple prepared pianos, a multitude of Japanese taiko drums, and a children's choir. Always good to have a children's choir. added into the mix of things, I think. I asked Jack how the idea for these live shows came about.
Well, this music was never actually really meant for... Never conceived with the idea of playing it live, but I was about 2 months ago, I was contacted by a conductor called Andre Derrida, who's a German... He's done things like Monkey Journey to the West. He was the conductor for the... Okay. For the everything like that. And he just said it would be really good to put on a show of, like, an integral show of Hidden Live with everything. And it's something, yeah, we'd thought about doing. And, yeah, a month later, it was, yeah, happened in Barbican Pompidou Centre. Then we're playing in Belgium and Holland.
It's interesting. It's they're quite sort of arty venues. Are they all seated?
Yeah.
It's quite visceral music to kind of play at a seated audience.
Yeah, I like seated things, though, because it makes the decision about what to do. For the audience's behaviour, it decides it for them. Because a lot of people, I don't know, our music is kind of between, kind of some people want to react to it in a certain way, or people don't know how to react to it necessarily. Like, it's there are elements of dance music to it, but there's elements that are as far away from that as you can get. And so it makes people, you know, it takes away the indecision kind of thing.
So you're performing these shows with a, what is it, 16-piece brass and woodwind?
Yeah, 15, 16-piece.
And two... Kodo,
what? Two percussionists, they play taiko drums, vibraphones, live Foley techniques, chains, tenor drums, and then conductor. And then us.
I mean, as you said, it's kind of an album that you never set out with the intention of reproducing it perfectly live. Is it more daunting trying to do that than it is sort of scaling it down so you could just do it yourselves or do it sampling or whatever?
Well, in some ways it's easier because it's already there kind of thing, but... It's complicated. I mean, it's like trying to put on a stock cabin opera or something. It's ridiculously kind of lavish because, yeah, we took advantage of the fact that it was we were working in a studio, so we could do things that are impossible. Like, the studio is a place where we can do things that are otherwise impossible. And now we're trying to make those impossible things happen live. So, but also, in fact, we've got children's choir at Barbican as well.
Are you nervous, or do you think it's going to... I mean, it must be difficult working with a composer. It must be a conductor rather. Yeah. Is it something that fills you with kind of dread, or is it?
No, I haven't thought too much about it. I mean, we've only got one day rehearsal as well before we do it.
Whoa.
with the orchestra, and then some more rehearsal on the day. But apparently, this is what they do all the time. You know.
Is it really?
Yeah.
They just sort of pile in there and they learn the stuff and they just go in and do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird actually. Like, it seems to me like orchestras are a lot more like rock and roll than rock and roll people. Rock and roll people tend to work really hard and stuff, whereas orchestras just like turn up drunk. You know? Right.
I mean, you're clearly not a band that set out doing things with with one eye on that all-important top 40 placing. Yet this album seems to have a real momentum behind it. When we did a thing earlier this month and we were talking about records that should have been nominated for the Mercury and weren't, your album came up over and over and over and over again, which I think is really intriguing because it is a, you know, it's a pretty difficult record. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the easiest sell in the entire world. Are you surprised that people have taken to it in the way they have?
I never really thought about, and this thing that people say, but I never thought about the audience when making this album. I probably did more for the first album because you're kind of summing up your history and stuff like that. The first album, whereas this album, we just wanted to do whatever we wanted to do. And also, it's not, you know, I think we were just in a position of being able to do whatever we want. And I always have had the idea that if you do that, then you'll find an audience, whereas if you do the same thing as other people, then you're all competing for the same audience. I found out that's not really true, and if you just do bland crap, then
people quite into it.
Yeah, people like it. But no, I feel like this is I felt that this is a more accessible album than our first one.
Have you had time to think about what you're going to do next?
Yeah, I'm at this weird stage where there's about four or five different albums that we could make next, and I don't really have a clue which one. Well, there's lots of musical ideas, but I don't really know the form. I've got kind of musical ideas, but I don't completely have the idea of the form. We're thinking of doing an EP of music that will be very different from Hidden. And then we've got another few other projects. One that's to do with kind of film performance and stuff like that that we might be doing. And I was thinking of building a hydraulophone as well.
What's a hydraulophone?
It's like a keyboard that is... A hydraulophone is any instrument that's powered by water, but...
Right.
Specifically a keyboard that's powered by water. It's like a fountain that it has holes in, but wow. Like the apertures of flute or whatever, and then you just put your fingers in.
What does it sound like?
Just kind of watery, I suppose. Like a sort of floaty sort of thing.
That's amazing. Is it a difficult thing to build? It sounds like quite a difficult thing to build.
I don't know. I'm just getting into it. It was only like last week that I had the idea.
Right. I mean, do you find that you say you've got all these kind of diverse ideas for what you want to do next? Do you find it something that only tends to coalesce once you get in the studio?
I don't know. Things start making sense. Even now, things that didn't make sense to me like 3 months ago, that didn't make sense to me more. But no, I especially Hidden, it was such a kind of sort of logistically dense thing to put off that we had to know like every inch of the music
really
before we went in there. Yeah.
So it's very heavily rehearsed before you go in.
Well, actually, it was very heavily written, like every single note, every single sound. And I just want to make.
Well, you actually scored it out.
Yeah. I had to learn to do that in order to do the album.
Jesus, how long did that take?
Only a couple of months, really, but I just did it all day.
Have you got any sort of... I mean, do you have any kind of background in things like musical notation?
No, not really, no.
Wow.
I played the cello for a while, but I just was sort of pretending to read the notes. Like, I was better at just hearing like, someone play it and then I play it back.
Jack Barnett there of These New Puritans. These New Puritans are not a band you could ever accuse of lacking ambition in what they do, which I suppose, you know, you can see in these live shows in that, you know, it's got a 16-piece brass and woodwind ensemble, all this kind of malarkey. And they're playing in these quite arty seated venues. What do you think about that, Rosie? Do you think that's going to make for a good show, or do you think that, you know, that's not really very rock and roll?
Well... it's not really very rock and roll, but what is anymore?
Yeah, good question.
I saw them very, very early on for the first album, so I haven't ever seen them try and do anything that recently, and it was super sparse and like spotlighted. And and actually, the first album was a lot more sparse than this one, and a lot more sort of desolate. So I would love to see it, and I would very much like to be sitting down
would for
one of their shows. Yeah. It's
I like
not
the
kind
way
of thing
you're
going to be pounding your fist in the air.
Yeah, you say that. I like the way you said that it kind of dictates audience behaviour. As anybody who saw Diva Fever's audition on The X Factor recently, which they started doing Proud Mary you know, the, as done by Ike and Tina Turner. And the woman out of the Pussycat Dolls was on the judging panel, stood up, leapt from her seat and started dancing. And nobody else did.
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen a million times. And you've got to try and find some way of getting back in your seat.
Whatever.
You know, either you just style it out, you know. So I wonder if anyone's going to be doing that at these New Puritan shows. Do you think they're unlucky not to get nominated for the Mercury Prize, Alex?
I think so. I mean, if the Mercury Prize is supposed to be about rewarding innovation and artistic risk taking, then that album certainly fulfills that criteria.
Is it a record you enjoy, or is it a record you admire?
I like it a lot, actually. I mean, I think it sort of taps into a bit of a, you know, it's a bit Benjamin Britten. It's mm-hmm. that, you know, it sort of goes back to that kind of British, slightly spooky, kind of a bit mystic sort of thing that's always been going on, but also brings a sort of industrial aspect to it as well. I mean, I think there haven't been many records made like this one. I have seen them actually perform it at the Highbury Garage, which is a typical indie rock venue, and they had a bit of woodwind and strings then, and I was impressed at how well they managed to pull it off.
I saw them in Brighton at Audio. A number of venues in Brighton that enables you not to see bands unless you're in the front row. You can't. There's not actually a stage, and they were on. It was the Great Escape Festival, and they were on a bill with like people like Fenix Solar and people who very much had their eyes clearly on the prize of, you know, commercial success. And they came on. It just sounded like the end of the world. There'd been this kind of like pop dance stuff happening, and then these New Puritans came on. It was like dubstep with somebody playing a bassoon over the top of it. And I sort of thought, you know what? Good for you, these New Puritans. You know, you're trying something different. I couldn't see what was going on stage, but it seemed quite dark and pounding.
I mean, in a way, it's turned into quite a fertile sort of, I'm not, you know, the kind of South End scene such as it was, but the Horrors did a very ambitious second album.
Indeed.
Today, and so have these New Puritans.
And that club that that it all sprang out of in South End, I remember Dorian Lynskey is often guest on the show, went down there, and he said that the stuff they were playing was just absolutely out of its mind, and it would be like, you know, an early acid house record followed by, you know, Release the Bats by the Birthday Party, and it seemed to make no sense whatsoever. And yet this sort of really interesting scene had coalesced around this kind of music. I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, because the people are very involved are all pretty young, they sort of put things together in a different way. You know, they've not got the same kind of context that you might have if you kind of lived through it the first time round. And yeah, I think it makes for something original.
Wicked. If you want to see Hidden live, the only UK date is at the Barbican on the 23rd of October, where they'll be supported by Dark Star, who will also be featured in Music Weekly very soon. Time for Singles Club now. We've each brought in a track to discuss, and this one was chosen by Rosie. Sounds. I think I'm coming down with something, and that sounds how the inside of my head feels at the moment. Rosie, that was King Knight by Salem.
Yeah,
tell us a little
I chose
bit about
that one because I do think that they've got their eye on the top four.
Yeah. Once again, that all important early evening ITV slot.
Exactly.
X Factor final guest appearances.
Or as it was last week, Christine Bleakley presents the reunion. Oh no, the final show of Simply Red.
You know? What a remarkable looking man Mick Hucknall is. I watched that. He looks like, maybe you don't remember him, 70s entertainer Charlie Drake. He does. Google a picture of Charlie Drake and you'll see what I mean. Why, Rosie?
Tim Jones wrote, who sits across from me every day, we spend a large part of our lives together. He wrote a piece for last week's Observer about Witch House, and he's been trying to expose various Witch House tracks to me and make me like them. And I remembered that I liked Salem. And one of the things that Witch House, Ghost Drone, you know, it's got all these ridiculous names. I know, it's just ridiculous. But they're certainly progenitors of it. They've been around for at least a couple of years now, and they've come back with this album. And I like I think there's just something about the, you know, it's reminds me of, it makes me think of, you know, that codeine effect, the Little Wayne, Chopped and Screwed.
Yep.
It makes me think of that. It's got some weird paganism in it. It's almost a bit like slowed down, you know, electronic body music that was made in, you know, it's kind of got all this stuff together, and somehow I do actually still find it listenable.
Excellent.
So yeah, and also another thing I like about this Witch House Zone drone, whatever the hell you want to call this scene, is there's a lot of young women in it. There's a half of Sailor Moon. It's very female orientated.
Okay, that's interesting. Are there Witch House clubs? Can you go out and
someone should start one?
Can you imagine?
There must be one.
It must be, it'll be amazing. Go out, bang a couple of these. Listen to Salem, Alex. What did you make of Salem?
Well, I did like it. I mean, it's got a kind of epic quality, hasn't it, that in a way we've heard a lot before. But that sort of deliberate distortion is unusual, isn't it? It's like, it's not kind of guitar distortion.
No.
It's actual sort of distorted, like your speakers have broken the way through. It has, you know, when everything's super kind of auto-tuned and very hi-fi, it still sounds weird to hear something like that and quite disconcerting.
That's very true, actually. I hadn't thought of it that way, yes.
And I thought that it's kind of the kind of choral bit at the end, while it was quite silly, it was sort of fairly affecting as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they perform. I've never seen them perform. I'm imagining a lot of dry ice. And in a way, you kind of hope that they're more that they're a bit less cliched than that. But I mean, there's definitely something there.
I've never seen a picture of them. They don't have, you know, the press. Oh, have you?
They're very good looking. Oh. They're gay, and they've got, but they look kind of long hair, loads of tattoos.
Really?
A bit metally.
But wow. Yeah, no, that's kind of how you'd imagine them today.
You know, I guess so. But they're striking looking. They've collaborated with the artist Terence Coe. So and Michael Stipe went to see them. So
wow.
The hipster credentials are pretty off the scale.
It's amazing. I would say that, once again, I say this sort of like every week, somebody brings in a new record. Okay, it sounds a bit like My Bloody Valentine. It does sound a bit like,
I mean,
you know
that,
what I mean?
That effect is on everything at the moment.
It really is. The influence of the, I think particularly the Tremolo EP by My Bloody Valentine seems to hang incredibly heavy over music that's being made at the moment. Anyway, King Knight by Salem is out now. Let's see what Alex Needham's brought in for us. That was Scandal at the Parkade by Owen Pallett. Owen Pallett, known for his work with the Arcade Fire, is he not?
He is, yeah. He's a bit of an arranger. He's sort of very in demand as a string arranger. And he also did the Last Shadow Puppets album.
Ah.
So, yeah, those are probably his two biggest projects. But he's been around for quite a while. He used to record as Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
But he's under his own name now. And he's kind of toured with people like Panda Bear and that sort of, you know, that kind of Canadian sort of Brooklyn scene. He's a bit of a prime mover in. But I think that I really like this record. It's what he does is he kind of plays various kind of violin bits, then loops them, or that's how he does it live anyway, and then sings over them. So it has this great kind of cumulative effect. And also the text, the way that he uses strings is quite unusual. Even in his arrangements, they're always quite obtrusive and quite percussive. He's sort of, you know, he doesn't use them like just a kind of backdrop for the guitars. And also it's kind of, I suppose, a bit like these New Puritans as well. It shows that how people who would have made indie records kind of 10 years ago are stretching themselves.
Yeah, oh no, definitely.
Going into looking at modern classical music and more avant-garde things and bringing those influences back into pop music.
I mean, opinion, has to be said, has been divided a little bit by this record. You know, comparisons have been made to the theme music to Fawlty Towers. and I thought it sounded a bit like when you used to get like Hungarian cartoons on the telly, on BBC Two at like 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, and a character was sneaking about in a Hungarian cartoon. This kind of music would normally be playing. Rosie, you thought it sounded like something else?
Yes, it sonically definitely reminds me of Arthur Russell, but that got me thinking that he, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the kind of musician he is and the kind of musician that Arthur Russell was, in the same way that you were saying he's embedded in the, you know, North American hipster scene, Arthur, but by the same token seems to do very different things and have many, you know, many strokes to what he does. Arthur Russell was, you know, playing with Philip Glass and then up and talking
making
heads,
disco
and
records,
and kind of all over the place. And I think there's I think it's a very nice, playful song, but I prefer, it was about 6 months ago, I think, he uploaded a couple of tracks with this one, Lewis Takes Action, and the other is Lewis Takes His Shirt Off, to his MySpace page, and they're very different from this, and I absolutely loved them at the time, so I prefer that. I prefer that much, much, much more pop of a record than this, which is obviously not attempting. Well, I don't think it is.
I mean, in a way, it seems quite. In a way, it does seem a bit slightly dry and quite formal. But I think maybe that's sort of what I like about it. And I think there is a kind of hidden humour. I actually think he probably is quite influenced by the Hungarian cartoons you speak of, because
yeah.
it's called a Swedish Love Story EP. So
yeah.
I think, you know, that kind of sort of Scandinavian film music,
yeah, animation
looms large. Also, I've just realised it's Grizzly Bear he toured with, not Panda.
Oh my god,
easy mistake.
Jesus, thank god you.
National Incident has just been averted. Scandal at the Parquet by Owen Pallett is the second track on his EP, A Swedish Love Story, which is out now. And now it's my turn.
Why doesn't my
That was All Packed Up by Idiot Glee, my choice of singles club this week. I don't know an enormous amount about Idiot Glee. I know they're American. I know they're Mormons. But, I mean, you know, there's loads of great Mormons in music. There's the Osmonds, and there's Brandon Flowers, and there's Lowe. So there you go. There's a grand, amazing, diverse tradition of Mormon music. I really liked it. It sounded to me like it was influenced by doo-wop. 50s doo-wop, and I think there's a great quote, Brian Eno, I think he said it was like the first music that ever grabbed him. He used to live near an Air Force base, and they had like American Forces radio, and he would tune in, and they'd be playing doo-wop records on that, and he said, you know, it sounded like music from Mars. And I think if you listen to a lot of set a record like I Only Have Eyes For You, there is something very weird about the amount of echo, and you know what I mean? I don't think they're setting out to make a weird record. And I think this captures something of that in a slightly modern way. I think it's a really good song. I really like the guy's voice. Rosie?
I really, really, really like it. It reminded me at first of a bit like the Perfume Genius record, not in melodic structure, but definitely in attempting that kind of crackled, faded out, haunted quality to the music, but at the same time sounds like something that was, you know, exactly like something that would be playing on local radio in the Midwest 60 years ago. And yet, like you, I don't know very much about him, but I'm definitely seduced by this style of music that's very popular with the young bands these days, which is, you know, definitely willfully removing themselves from the world. You know, that is what you feel like when you listen to this, and it's, sorry to bring back the dreaded genre of chill wave, but it's that there is that there's something apolitical about it. There's something about that's supposed to transport you away, and that combined with something that's kind of a little like the Everly Brothers, just perfect for me. I absolutely loved it.
Excellent, Alex.
Yeah, I thought it brought out the otherworldly qualities of that music. I mean, it reminded me a bit actually of when David Lynch sort of recontextualized all that stuff, didn't he? Around the time of Twin Peaks, when he started working with Angelo Badalamenti, and they made very kind of spooky sort of doo-wop kind of records.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a very similar kind of atmosphere, only when then it would probably be really difficult to make a record like that. Now you can do it in your bedroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
As this 22-year-old Mormon guy has.
I mean, I just think it's a really interesting piece of music. It's difficult, you know, it's hard to place it within a genre. It didn't sound like anything else really that's around at the moment, which is why I liked it. All Packed Up by Idiot Glee is out on Moshi Moshi on October the 4th. Now, a few of your comments on last week's show. Remember, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is the place to leave posts for us. On Dave Sitek, F-Pole writes, "The Dave Sitek album is great, and yeah, I agree that it works well as a whole. His producing is really distinct. I knew it was Sitek when I heard it, but it still sounded like TV on the radio. I think it sounds quite a lot like Zero, the single off the last Yeah Yeah Yeah's album."
Which he produced.
Which he produced. Did he?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because that doesn't strike me as being, you know, very obviously in the Dave Sitek style.
No, I wouldn't have said
I wouldn't have picked that out. We were saying last week we thought it had a very distinctive style. There you go. Just going to show how wrong you can be. on the Grinderman single, Lowdown 01 writes, "Worm Tamer, seriously? You guys really like that song? 2 points. One, wasn't this theme already explored in a much funnier way in the movie Spinal Tap? Two, if it wasn't Nick Cave, would anyone care? Just saying." Controversial.
Just saying.
And on CeeLo, regular poster PhilJones87 writes, "Really great to see CeeLo getting some praise. His verse on Guess Who from the Goody Mob album Soul Food in 95 is seriously brilliant, and I'd recommend it to everyone, hip hop fan or not. Definitely something of a late bloomer when you consider his first appearance was on Outkast's debut in 94. It's quite a rare and pleasant surprise to see someone who has essentially made exactly the music he wanted to at all points throughout his career in the most trend-obsessed genre around achieve recognition." That's a very good point. I think he's a bit out on his own and yet still successful. Thanks as always for your feedback. Keep it coming. Ah, moving on. The disco revival, such as it is, new disco, new Balearic, call it what you like, shows no signs of slowing. You've got people like Greg Wilson, the DJ History Boys, all those sort of people regularly performing around the country. Many of the tracks they play will be DJ-friendly re-edits, layered with samples and with a cleaner, more meaty sound than the 70s originals. Leo Zero is a producer. He began life, well, he didn't begin life, but he was originally in Chicane, when Chicane were good, which is one of those things that you say, and it's like when you go, yeah, Simple Minds is good albums. And everyone goes, oh, what? First Chicane single was amazing, and he was on that.
Did you listen to it in the Mixmag office?
We did listen to it a lot in the Mixmag office, yeah. What do you mean by that? I don't like your snidey tone. It was a big tune, Offshore by Chicane, great record. He's been reworking hip-hop, house and disco, and also other stuff as well. I think, sort of quite interestingly, his re-edits venture a bit further out than just disco stuff. But he's been doing it for over 15 years. I caught up with him recently to learn more about the re-edit process. First, let's have a listen to a track from his Super Edits Volume 1 CD. This is Jammin' on a Dream. We are always running for the thrill of it, thrill of it. Always pushing up the hill, searching for the thrill of it. All and all and all, we are calling out loud again. Never looking down, I'm just an aura, what's in front of me. So yeah, just to begin with, just tell me a little bit about sort of basically your background and how you got to where you are now.
I started off as a DJ and learned to use a sampler in the mid-90s and was always collecting the kind of records I make now, which are essentially cut and paste records. And was always collecting music and with a view to doing likewise with my own music collection.
When you say cut and paste records, what do you mean?
Records like Cold Cut, Bits and Pieces, History of Hip Hop by Double D and Stynski. These were records that sort of emerged in the 80s around sort of hip hop culture, but were basically using whatever methods were available to construct a club record in a similar fashion to what had been before termed as a medley. And I suppose these medleys, by the skills that were being evolved and the equipment that evolved, like samplers, turned into something a little bit more intricate. So they weren't medleys anymore, they were mega mixes.
Right. And so when did you start releasing them yourself under the name Leo Zero?
Well, I released them under a multitude of daft names for about 10 years. So Leo Zero's a fairly recent, similarly daft name. But yeah, it's a recent incarnation. And before that, I had a label called Easter Bay, which was probably surfaced around the same time as Black Cock and the Idiot Boys material. And we were all kind of feeding off the same club environment. And
just to sort of interrupt for the benefit, Black Cock is Harvey's re-edit label, isn't it? DJ Harvey, who holds a lot of sway in this kind of scene. That's like mid-90s, yeah.
So you had this lineage all the way through the 90s where people were getting more and more focused on disco and doing the filter thing and doing and sort of a bit of a French take on it, but maybe with a bit more of a looseness. So the Idiot Boys were filtering their disco tracks and doing a lot of live dubs on the mixing desk. I was lucky enough to hang out with the Idiot Boys when they were mixing something down at Phase Action's studio where they recorded Phase Action stuff. And, you know, it was all very live, and they're working all the dubs and the delays together like a four-handed monster on the mixing desk. You know, it's totally live and a very skilled way of doing it. You know, you have to tidy up slightly afterwards, maybe when you've done a live jam like that. But it's a way of doing an edit where you're very much a performer. You know, and it's like the Jamaican style of doing it, like a Lee Perry dub. I often do an activity where I will literally go on a website, get the newest acapellas that have been siphoned from wherever they should have been resting in, you know, file sharing sites in a record company's, you know, back end that someone's found, and all of a sudden you've got the acapella version of a new hit. And I'll literally play that in iTunes and play a load of other things in Ableton. And I've literally got two things, and I'll often play more than one acapella, and I'll have these two scrolling libraries playing together, and with a bit of luck, you hit something that works. I mean, I've seen enough on the internet of people going, oh God, what are you doing, you know? And that's fine. And I kind of like that. And I snigger to myself and think, well, there's enough people that kind of are not going to be horrified. You know, I did Lou Reed, Satellite of Love, and that was another kind of watershed for people going, oh dear, look at me, you know, with very scornful looks. And yeah, okay, I understand where you're coming from, and I understand how revered these people are, but it's just a re-edit. It's not, I'm not pissing on, you know, they're golden artwork. I'm pissing about with it. I'm not, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be seen as sacrilegious. And the re-edit thing causes more waffle than any other genre I've ever seen, in terms of people going, oh, there's too many of them, they're too, they're really badly done, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, this is such a boring viewpoint. What you should actually look at is say, for one point in history, more people are actually interacting with the music they listen to than ever before. They've got Ableton. You know, people who are really passionate music collectors have now started going, well, I've got an idea of how I want this to sound and I want to tweak it.
Is it that, I mean, there does seem to have been a vast number of re-edits. I mean, if you get, you know, a mail out from a shop like Juno or Phonica or something like that, it's pretty much packed. You know, the shelves are groaning with re-edits of old disco tracks or whatever. Is that because of the rise of Ableton? Why has there suddenly been such a sort of surge of them in the last few years?
Yeah, I think Ableton's facilitated it. I think people can make a little bit of money out of them, and I think there's a monetary cause for it. And that's a whole other point for debate, whether you should be doing that and whether things should be edited. I think people are generally into them, and I think vinyl is important for them, because a lot of the time with re-editing, it's to do with actually sonically juicing things up and making things sound a little bit more bright and a little bit, putting more clarity into the equation, so that you can perhaps play something in a club that you couldn't play before. So the reason they end up on vinyl, and there's a lot of them around, is that that is a process. And the end game, if you make something, if you remaster something and you get it sounding better than it was before, the end game really is to put it on a piece of vinyl, and then it's absolutely distilled for good. And if you want something to sound good in a nightclub, I'm sorry, but you need to play it off vinyl, really.
yourself ever had any legal comeback?
The first record I did was, I made the record first, you know, got a sampler, worked with my mate, and we made this 12-inch and sold it out of the boot of my Fiat Uno. The next week, Deconstruction Records and Virgin Records were fighting over it, and then, you know, a few weeks later, it was in the top 40. And then 1 week later, after that, the rights owner to one of the vocal parts of this track said, "Hello, what are you doing with this? Because you've been so rude and naughty, we're going to own 100% of this track, and you've got to take it off the shelves and blah, blah, blah." So my pop stardom with my collaged... This track had, we worked out, in the vocal side of it alone, had about 20 different sample sources. So this guy had just taken ownership of a collage. You know, he's gone, "I own this now." And that has been the one time that I've kind of brushed up against the legal side of it. And I have to say, I'm a moral person and I don't make money out of the re-edits thing. I do it to disseminate the edits.
That was Leo Zero talking to me recently. You could hear in the background there towards the end of it, I think one of my favourite things that he's done, which is a reworking of Prefab Sprout's Bonnie from the album Steve McQueen, which he sort of beefed up for the dance floor a bit. That was the track that sort of brought him to my notice as a re-edit kind of person. Are either of you fans of this kind of stuff? I mean, or is it just me because I'm a kind of aging disco dad?
I feel bad now because he was basically saying there, don't be so boring, don't be so close-minded. But my initial feeling about the, you know, when I went on the SoundCloud page and thought, oh, no, this is not about sacred cows, but was about, oh, I feel like this has just been done a little bit, you know, and it's too many DJs or it's, you know, as we said before, the dreaded word mashup.
Yeah.
But in, you know, in its best form, that's, you know, that way of looking at music is Leo Zero, you know, in its worst form, it's bloody Utah Saints doing getting the Running Man together with Cloud Busting by Kate Bush.
That was a great record.
But and when I was on the SoundCloud page, I listened to his version of Lissy's "When I'm Alone," which is absolutely brilliant.
He's a really good remixer in his own right as well.
So
I think.
Good.
And one of the things I like about what he does, apart from when he takes something that I know really well and slightly recontextualizes it, like the Prefab Sprout track, is and one of the things I like about the sort of re-edit thing is when they take a piece of music that you would never have heard and sort of present it. I think there's something quite open and charming about someone going, "I found this amazing record, I've just sort of tweaked it a little bit." And there's a track of his called Hey Ho, which is a reworking of a Vangelis track with, I believe, Demis Roussos on vocals. And it's mind-blowing. It may well be on his website. I don't think it's yeah, I think it's different to mashups, which is sort of a bit played out. Alex, is this any of this floating your boat?
I do like it. Yeah, I mean, sort of boosting things for the dance floor. I mean, it's a pretty old tradition,
indeed,
really, isn't it? It's just been done in a slightly more extreme way.
Yeah.
I think one of my favourite ever is the Glimmer Twins did "Same Old Scene" by Roxy Music.
Yeah,
and their version is a lot better than the original, I think.
Wow.
And but it's interesting what he was saying about people wanting to get involved with, like, changing the record itself.
Yeah.
Because it's something that the internet's facilitated, like, everywhere. Like, obviously, on the Guardian's website, you can get involved with our content and do, and, you know, kind of open source technology generally. And it's interesting that that's kind of...
Yeah, it's interesting that people don't just want to listen to music now. They actually want to, like, muck around with it, you know, and tweak it to their own specifications. Why do you think we all... I mean, as you say, this is a tradition of tweaking things for the dance floor that dates back to really kind of, early to mid-70s. People like Walter Gibbons and stuff like that were doing it in New York. Before there were 12-inch remixes, they were doing it on reel-to-reel tapes. Why do we always go back to disco? Disco is always with us. Disco was a big thing in the 90s, a lot of disco house about. Disco's a big thing now. It's like inescapable.
I think it's never gone away. I mean, ultimately, people will always want to dance. It's like in the whole kind of dance music's dead, you know, that we had for most of the last decade. I mean, you know, that form of dance music may be dead, but people will always want to go to clubs and, you know, hang out with their mates and, you know, do other, you know, less legal things.
But also I think part of the reason some of these re-edits work, and if you even go back to Scissor Sisters doing Comfortably Numb, it's taking the, you know, dance music works at its best, in my opinion, when you get the euphoria and of the actual sound of the music combined with melancholy.
Absolutely.
And that's what a lot of these do, is they take the melody from a sad pop song and beef it up a bit, and it always works.
Yeah, there's always an undertow of melancholy, all the best disco records, exactly. You know, how euphoric they sound. Native New Yorker by Odyssey, which you always think of as this very glittery record. Listen to the lyrics of that, it makes you want to slit your wrists. For more on Leo Zero, check out leozero.com, where you can find plenty of other remixes to have a listen to. Well, that's your lot for this week. Thank you very much, Alex, for coming in. Lovely to see you as ever.
Thanks, lovely to be here.
And cheers, Rosie. See you next week.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much to our producer, Pete. I'm Alexis Petridis. See you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.